Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. I think it's slowly dawning on all of us that it's possible to think that possibly, maybe, there's been massive cock-up around energy and that we continue to kind of fumble the ball as well. So it's all the front pages today. The Mail is saying Ryan Cabinet was warned of blackouts. So the Mail is saying the government was repeatedly warned about threats to Ireland's electricity security since it came into power more than 2 years ago. The Sunday Times, parties clash over energy windfall tax. So they're saying, Aoife Moore and Laura Roddy, saying Fine Gael is against imposing a windfall tax on energy companies because of concerns it could scare off investors. Whereas the Sunday Independent, Jody Corcoran, government to hit energy companies with a token windfall tax. But what it says here, the government believes a windfall tax on such companies would be popular with the public. So that's kind of why they're doing it. It's a bit of window dressing. And we did hear this muttering during the week about, oh, it'd be good for social cohesion, even though it might not be a good idea in practicalities. Whereas in the Business Post, Minister admits that businesses are now under threat. So this is Michael McGrath, the Minister for Public Expenditure, who's saying businesses are coming to him saying that we're going to be in trouble with electricity bills. It says in this, at the same time, listen to this now, at the same time as the CRU is imposing new tariffs on businesses, the Department of Enterprise and Trade is expected to receive state aid approval from the European Commission this week to proceed with a new energy support fund to provide multi-million euro grants to businesses hit by surging electricity costs. So on one hand, we are taking it away from them, and on the other hand, giving it back to them. Off lead on the front of the Business Post is a continuing fallout from Robert Troy. Election candidates could be forced to disclose their property and business interests before running for public office as part of a major overhaul of the country's ethics legislation. The Sun is leading with Stephen Carney. He killed his partner, Amanda Jenkins, and he's being allowed to meet his family outside of prison now, days out from his open prison, and Amanda Jenkins' family are upset about that. And the Mirror, get out your violins, new 1 million X Factor bullying claim. Six more contestants make allegations against the show that they were sleep deprived and all kinds of things while they were trying to be stars. The comment from the company seems to be mainly involving saying Simon Cowell knew nothing. So I'm happy to clarify that Simon Cowell apparently knew nothing about all this. Now, our panel this morning, Ono Nocton is Director of Public Affairs at Heenahan, the PR agency. Martin Beans Ward is a stand-up comic and writer. Alison O'Connor is a political commentator with the Irish Examiner. And Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh, who joins us from our Waterford studio, is a law lecturer at SETU. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Alison, will we start with the Mail? There's a few threads to pull at here on energy. So the Cabinet was warned of blackouts. Like, we've all been warned, haven't we? The Business Post is blue in the face from front page stories about energy before any of us were listening. So this is no surprise that we knew all this, is it?
No, I suppose we should start by saying if you're looking for a bit of a lift this morning, stay away from the papers.
Yes.
The Business Post, to be fair to it, has been warning about this for a long time. I remember in June, I was part of a group of Irish journalists in Brussels where we were given briefings by the EU Commission. And I remember thinking at that time, God, we are really shagged for the winter in terms of, they were quite clear that there was enough food. Do you remember there was a period where we were wondering about vegetable oil and the cost of all of that? That there was enough food in Europe and generally in the world. It was just a case of getting it to the people who needed it most at prices they could afford. But that was certainly not the case for energy. And we were hearing all about the different countries doing exercises and, you know, who would have their lights turned out first, countries sharing energy, all of that. So that was when Mairead McGuinness, the EU commissioner, also said that she thought Ireland would have difficulties this winter. So I've been speaking to a number of people the last couple of weeks, in and around government. And I suppose it's in lots of ways, it's very difficult to get a straight answer. If you even consider the question of can the UK turn off the gas to us and not Northern Ireland? One person will tell you yes. another person will tell you no.
Because so it's there difficult. Is an All-Ireland.
There is, yeah. So apparently it comes down from Scotland. It's the north, it's ourselves, and it's the...
It's the one connector.
Yeah, it's the Isle of Man. And you, I mean, I keep thinking of this column I read last Saturday week, Matthew Parrish, the former Conservative MP, writing about Liz Truss. And one column ended with who was now looking like a dead cert to be the next British Prime Minister. And the last line of one part was, "She's bonkers." Yeah. And this is something that
Dan O'Brien, he's a fairly sober kind of an individual.
Absolutely. Is quoted, and I think it's in the Sunday Times. This is the piece by Julianne Corr, and the headline says it all. "The big squeeze meets the big freeze. Just how bad will this winter get?" And Dan is quoted saying, "I'm concerned that Liz Truss's Prime Minister would threaten or actually turn off the gas tap over the Northern Ireland Protocol dispute." Now, somebody within government said to me this week, we were talking about that, they said, but that would be akin to a declaration of war. And I mean, it would be an incredible, I mean, it's almost difficult, but I mean, wouldn't it have been amazing to think that what Liz Truss said about France this week, was it an ally?
And when you look
Britain
at the febrile atmosphere in Britain at the moment, almost the threat of a workers' revolution going on there,
Going back to your original question, I think being in government at the moment is a really uncomfortable place with the prospect of the winter. There's a very good, with the Mail, there's a very good timeline piece, current events, Eamon Ryan was warned back in June of 2020. We may be reading this throughout the winter as we shiver and by candlelight.
Yeah, but what I read between the lines there as well, though, is that Eamon Ryan's people are very clearly saying Eamon Ryan might have been told, but he also brought it to the Cabinet's subcommittee and told everybody else.
You have to be fair here as well. There was 2 years of COVID. The Greens, I mean, we cannot forget the climate emergency that is ongoing. The Greens are constantly fighting an uphill battle. But this is something that Conor Skeaghan addresses.
I think we're in the short term at the moment. Okay,
there's going to be a lot of difficulty politically.
We'll come back to that. Let's hear everyone else's opening gambits on this. Now, Onor Nocton, in the spirit of the post Robert Troy period, declarations of interest here, SSE Airtricity are a client of your company.
Yeah. But I don't work with SSE Airtricity per se, but they're a client of the company. And I did work in the ESB many years ago, so I have a fair understanding.
What was your position in
the
ESB?
Head of Communications, but that was 2007, finished there.
So given your expertise from the ESB, so what's your read on it?
Well, it's a very complex situation. Energy markets throughout the world, very, very complex. And it's very scary reading, looking at Bloomberg, talking about European traders talking about that there's no end to likely to the raising costs of electricity across Europe for this winter. So that's scary. But where we
traders aren't great at the long term, you'd have to say in general, though. Like, I mean, maybe I'm clinging to this, but you know, you look at stock market trading, it's driven by short term sentiment usually. They clearly lost their nerve last week, didn't they?
Yeah, but at the same time, the trend is up. And there's nobody seeing a plateauing or coming down anytime in the near future. That is the worry. But the worry for us is, and there's an awful lot of column inches dedicated to who knew, who should have done what, an awful lot of finger pointing going on, talking about Dermot McCarthy, the former Secretary General, having to come along and carry out a review to find out how did this happen. But from my point of view, the worrying thing is there's nobody coming up with a solution other than maybe the Commission for Regulation of Utilities saying we'll actually impose extra costs on large companies if they use energy at certain times.
And on consumers, yeah.
But the question is, like every other state in Europe are now topping up their gas reserves, oil reserves, and we don't have any of those.
We have oil reserves, don't we?
Yeah, we have a certain amount, but we have no gas, and the vast majority of our energy is generated using gas. So if anything happens, the interconnector that Alison was talking about there, the lights go out.
Do you understand the bidding system, which seems to have fallen down very badly? I read in the Business Post today that the ESB won a bid to provide, they seem to have pulled out of 5 gas powered plants in the Dublin area that they were scheduled to build.
That's right, yeah. But
do you know what happened?
I don't know why they pulled out of those or what the inference was. But the regulator or Airgrid, they hold auctions. You know, not people say we will actually supply X amount of gas, and then they win or X amount of energy. They win that competition, and they're expected to deliver power plants then to to deliver that. And but these are huge capital investments involved in that. That goes then back to the Department of Finance are worried about deterring these people.
We'll come on to the windfall tax in a minute, maybe. Martin Beans Ward, thoughts?
So the windfall tax, you just mentioned it there. So the one, what was work out? 100 million is what they're hoping to claw back, which is going to result in what? 18 euro per annual bill for the customer.
Yeah, but as we read in the Sunday Independent, it would be popular with the public, they feel, as a gesture. Maybe.
So 18 euro over the course of a year. But, Well, a little over a euro a month, that's really going to help people, is it? Let me tell you, the last time they gave out 100 million was to the customers, was to help with the, what was it, the energy account. It was meant for 200 euro, and that was excluding VAT, so it worked out like 176 euro or something per household. That was 100 million euro. So here we that was also my highest ever bill. That came out, it was between April and June. So that was meant to be 200 euro. When it came to my actual bill, this is in the middle of the summer now, my bill came after the thing was taken off it. It still came up to over 300 euro for 2 months. Mm. So
in the summer.
In the summer. My apartment is all electric. All of it. We had a recent outage there in Clare Galway. Three or 4 days ago. And it was only for an hour. But it was a horrible taste of what might come in the future. Because there was no shower. The water needed a pump to push through the pipes. There was no cooker. There were no lights. So if this does get worse, that 100 million euro, that 18 euro over the course of a year, that's not going to even touch the sides.
It's interesting you say about a power cut, and we've kind of forgotten what they're like. But Brian Lucy points out in that same piece that Dan O'Brien was in, he points out that also Wi-Fi will be gone. We're much more dependent, as you say, the shower needs a pump now and everything, much more dependent than in the good old days where you could light a candle and open it.
Brendan, that's in the household.
Get out
that's
the primus.
You're not allowed to burn candles anymore, by the way, but the Green Party says there's emissions that comes off that as well. Yeah. So no, there's none of that. Or turf, by the way, we can't burn turf. So God help those poor old people in rural Ireland into a harsh winter.
Jennifer Kavanagh.
Yeah, 18 quid off your bill over an entire year is probably all it will take to charge your laptop. So it's not really that much at all. But the one thing I keep coming back to, like when I did the junior cert, which wasn't today or yesterday, it was actually on the syllabus about oil, gas, coal, all being finite resources that we were going to run out of. And I think for my generation, the biggest gripe that we have is this was known about for years in the long term that there was going to be problems. And to our cost, we pretty much trusted the generations ahead of us who are actually in power, in control of these things, to come up with some sort of a solution. And everything has got much more energy intensive. You know, back in the day, it was just your telly, your cooker, your lights were running off the electricity. As Martin said, your shower needs the pump. We're all being told to get electric cars. Everything has just become far more energy intensive. And who I really feel sorry for is the people who have decided that they're going to go with the remote working, that in a way that's a big let off for the companies that would have been paying the energy bill for the office, which is now being put on the person who is living at home.
Yeah. Now, on what you say about that we knew that fossil fuels were finite and everything else, Alison, you touched there on Conor Skehan, who, as Conor Skehan would, is kind of saying that the promoters of green energy are responsible in some way for this, because there isn't enough green energy to go around, and have we been running down our fossil fuels too quickly?
Yes, and I would go the road with Conor to a certain point, but he doesn't offer any solutions then. It's not easy. It's not easy being the Green Party and trying to get these things over the line. We've seen during the summer the temperatures. Aidra was driving back up from West Cork, I think it was two Saturdays ago, stopped in Cork City, we got back into the car and the car was registering 30 degrees. We can't ignore that either. And the Greens are obviously trying to move us on away from dirty fossil fuels. This is a crisis that has hit. So we knew it was coming, but then you have the war in Ukraine that has made it all far worse. And yet we can't just abandon you know, renewables now. It's to try and make it so that we... I mean, it's an almost impossible ask at the moment.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone's suggesting we abandon renewables.
No, but there's a danger.
A just transition in some way. For when the wind doesn't blow, and as Conor Skeehan says, at times wind is only providing 2%, when the sun doesn't shine, we need gas.
We do, but there are currently like massive amounts of megawatts of wind energy stuck in the planning system. I believe that the AG has been looking at those laws. They're going to come out. It is, of course, going to be really this idea of the Greens being so intransigent in terms of LNG, and yet... Fine Gael in particular, and I'm sure others saying, well, look, we're in this crisis, we have to do something.
So this is an LNG terminal for importing gas in Shannon, shovel ready to go, all planning, all environmental impact done. They're saying it could be built in a year at no cost to the state, and the Greens won't have it.
But part of the problem then is an awful lot of the solutions, actually. We need something for the next 10 weeks, and a lot of the solutions won't be ready until the end of the decade.
And
Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, there's another problem with LNG, because the amount of ships that are able to transport that, there's a lack of those. And yes, you could say the war in Ukraine, but there was always problems with gas supply, with Russians turning off the taps to Eastern Europe. And the whole idea of that £200 onto your energy bill, that was actually decided on before anything happened in Ukraine. And as well as that, the price has been going up even before any of this started. So I think in a way, the Ukraine situation is a handy cop-out to a certain degree. There has always been problems.
Yeah, but there's no doubt that the Ukraine situation has made it much, much, much worse.
Yeah, but it was already a situation before that.
Yeah, OK. So look, I'm conscious we've done 15 minutes. Of isn't it awful now? Honor Nocton, can you suggest are there answers to this?
I'm afraid I can't, but I suppose it goes back to the LNG, by the way. The planning, the Onboard Planola has to rule on that now. It's expected shortly, so they may or may not.
Ryan has made it clear to Onboard Planola that he is against this.
As opposed to that, the minister with responsibility for, as Antonish says, well, you know, planning system has to be adhered to, you know, whatever decisions are made.
But the Greens are capable of acting politically on this as
exactly,
well.
Exactly,
but
even if the Greens weren't the issue, people will take judicial reviews and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So Alison is right. Even if Board Planner says go ahead, and the company, I think Fortress Energy, I think they're ready to go, it could still take much longer than we expect. And the problem is in the here and now. And as I understand it, the problem is to do with storage, which is what...
We don't really have any storage.
We don't have it.
We did see on the news the other night a new battery pack has been built in Dublin somewhere, a very large battery pack. Yeah. And they're building, apparently, the world's largest flywheel is being built down the country to store.
But I mean, all that stuff is fabulous. Yeah. But it's in, like, Minister Eamon Ryan did an interview with Brian Dobson during the week. And he did say the lights will not go out. Yeah. Now, whether that will come back to haunt him or not. He then went on, and most of the stuff, and I listened back to it yesterday actually, was future, conditional, where this is going to happen, that is going to happen. Like, for the world, we need it. We need those things to happen, without a doubt. But for this winter and next winter, we are worried in the short term about what is going to happen. And I think it is a very acute worry, and politically, it is a massive worry for the government. And I think nobody is really sure what's going to happen and I suppose nobody knows whether Putin is going to turn down the lever or how far down he is going to turn it.
Or others along that same pipeline, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, because
unfortunately, fossil fuels tend to be owned by kind of semi-autocratic or autocratic countries.
I mean,
remember when we were looking, owns a lot of the oil and gas.
There is an element of we're in sort of Hail Mary territory, because I mean, you remember with COVID vaccines and the idea of sharing that, and that we're looking for solidarity and this is more to do with countries on the mainland of Europe who are all connected, the notion that they will be that they'll be sharing fuel and that. And I think it's also important to make the point about psychologically for everybody. This is the third winter now that we're facing into with a sense of dread. the last two being COVID related, and we don't know where COVID is going to go this winter. But this is really unknown territory.
Well, look,
and
not for people who are not to add to that sense of dread for people, we should say that they are very much talking down the possibility of power cuts.
Indeed, the politicians
are saying that.
And I suppose we have to mention the upcoming budget, where the government is saying that they are going to. I think politically they were correct not to have had a mini budget. I think that bread would have been long eaten and forgotten. So that we have the budget on the 27th of September. And but I suppose part of the problem is it's so eagerly anticipated.
It'll be the biggest show in town.
It'll be the biggest show in town. Yeah. And you'd nearly worry about overshooting the mark
about,
in some ways, given
that
there's going to be another difficult winter next year.
Well, Martin, did you go?
Do you know what, though? Like, we talk about anticipation there. So, yeah, the budget does come out on the 27th of September. And guess what happens a couple of days after that? Electricity are going for a 45% price hike. So that's coming just after the budget's going to be released. So no matter how good that budget comes across for the average consumer, price hikes are set at 45%. The only good news that's coming out of all this is the regulator saying that there won't be any disconnections before the next 3 to 6 months. So that's a small little bit of breathing space for the average consumer.
Yeah.
But it's a 45% price hike. That's just one company. And apparently there's been
Did you have electricity going up, by the way?
Yeah. Going up. It doesn't stop going up.
No, growing up. Growing up, did you have electricity all the time?
Well, actually, I was talking to somebody about this just a while ago. They were saying that they remember the power cuts from the 80s and the 90s. And I was like, well, we were actually quite lucky. It was the only privilege travellers had because we always had a generator and we always had gas heating. So it was the only time in Irish history where the settled people were looking out from the dark houses, peering through the windows and pulling back the curtains, looking at the big lit up mobile home across the field. So, but we would have had, so like I moved.
And did you operate all the time off generators, gas bottles, that kind of thing?
We're traveling. But then we settled down when I was like 7 or 8, and then we had electricity. So okay. And indoor plumbing, Brendan. Indoor plumbing. Is that?
Yeah. Of course. So okay, before that, what was the situation?
Outdoor plumbing.
Right.
Yeah. Kind of like parts of Cork, actually. You're from Cork yourself. There's still parts of Cork that would have the old traditional outhouses and things like that, as there is in Connemara. But for us, there would have been toilets in the caravan, and there would have been places we would have stayed, would have had toilets and things like that. But like, okay, so when we talk about how hard it might have been back then, we're now looking at the possibility where every Irish person is facing a situation where they may not have electricity. And when we talk about indoor plumbing, that's all based around electricity in my house as well. So, like, okay. If there's no water being pushed through the pipes, through the pump.
Okay.
We'll be back to the fields, Brendan. We'll be back to the fields.
Now, we'll move on to Robert Troy, still kind of dominating the papers today, and I suppose the fallout from it. And there's a lot of rehashing, but there is one, that piece on the front of the Business Post, Alison, which is... that this report, which is coming out of the Department of Public Expenditure, to recommend that election candidates disclose business interests when they run for election.
Yes, I'd like to just say one last thing on the other, that if people want to be cheered up, read Liam Collins in the Sunday Indo.
Yes, wonderful tell us
piece.
About Liam Collins.
Yeah, Liam Collins has this wonderful piece about trying to ease the cost of living with everything going up, and he talks about showers and then about having children in the house and how expensive that is. But at one stage, he quotes Brendan Behan, recalled his granny washing herself once a year, whether she was dirty or not. But he's basically saying the pendulum has swung the other way now. He talks about the entering the realm of the 3-minute shower, and if you can't get clean in that time frame, you know, tough. And about going to Mead Street to a butcher and buying liver and eating sardines.
And these aren't the sardines now you get in Portugal.
Oh, absolutely. In extra virgin olive oil. So he says... close to the end, he says, before complaining about the rising cost of living, start thinking about ways to avoid it and doing your bit to save the planet along the way. So okay. It's well worth a read and it'll definitely give you a lift.
Would you be doing 3 minutes in the shower?
I think a 3 minute shower is eminently doable. Maybe I'm showing up something about my personal
hygiene.
Not for us
bigger legends,
I could do 2 minutes, no problem. Oh. Alison, what are you doing to cut
your personal hygiene?
Cut your cloth at the moment. I wouldn't dare.
Isn't it interesting that there is? I've heard people in government mention this "Reduce Your Use" campaign that was launched in April. I mean, I went and looked that up the other day because I don't know whether anyone in this studio is aware of that campaign or aware of. I know we were told the other recently by which the regular about this notion of between 5 and 7, but I actually think that consumers are dying to get advice on how to cut down electricity. And not just for the fuel, but even in wider terms for the planet, and that sense of advice and momentum that we would have got done very well with during COVID is just not there.
Well, I think they're afraid to tell people that you should be cutting down electricity use because people might freak out, as they can tend to do when they're told, if they're told to slow down the car.
No, but Brendan, I don't think so. I think
it was ridiculous
when Eamon Ryan, who keeps getting mentioned every 5 minutes here, but when Eamon Ryan quite rightly said that if you drive more slowly, you use less fuel. He was ridiculed, and he was entirely correct in that. But I actually think people would be delighted to get that sort of advice.
Oh, and what are you doing to cut down on the cost of living?
Yeah, I'm going to give Liam Collins a bit of advice because part of he's writing about. He was in Ballsbridge and he bought a pint of stout and a gin and tonic and it cost him €17. Now, in the interest of research, I text my barman, Paddy Sweeney, of Mahon's Bar in Kildare. €13 will get you the exact same drink in Kildare Town. He is free travel.
Liam Collins would have to cycle out to Kildare.
No, he's free travel.
Jennifer.
Yes?
What are you doing to cut your cloth at the moment in terms of cost of living stuff?
Well, I've been facilitated with using the Waterford studio, so I don't have to drive for 4 hours today. Yeah. So that's a definite start. Definitely one thing newspapers could do is on their recipe columns have a moratorium on any recipe that wants you to use an oven for more than 90 minutes.
Okay, yeah. And maybe Eamon Ryan will tell us most recipes seem to be fan 200 or fan 180. Maybe there's slow cooking could come back into fashion.
Or everyone just go back to ranges and doing scones at the same time as roasting their chickens.
Yeah.
But isn't
Martin,
there
what have you been doing to cut back?
Well, actually, so I've started doing a lot of walking. So even like little trips to the shop and things like that, that's more or less changed. And to be fair, I'm fairly energy conscious anyway. Like if I was, for example, going for a drive, I'd use that opportunity to charge the phone, or even cooking. I tend to cook in batches, so I'd have a meal, cooked and put in the fridge and have it maybe the next day or 2 days after that or something like. So I'd be quite conscious in that regard, but at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, I live in essentially a big microwave. Like everything's electric around me. Mm-hmm. So how energy conscious can you become?
Yeah. Okay.
But there's also the sense, isn't there? But I mean, I find myself in the supermarket, you're putting things back, whatever. But there's also the sense that no matter where you go, no matter what shop you're in or what business, that there's gouging going on as well. And you'd have to say that for sure with the energy.
We don't know that it's gouging.
We don't know, but I'd be like for... And I mean, I was very happy to see that yesterday, to read Elaine Lockton, the Examiner, that the Hotel Federation were in with Pascal Donoghue, the Finance Minister, to talk about VAT in the budget and that he apparently gave them a flea in their ears about price gouging over the last number of months. So, like, I mean, I think it has to be.
Are the likes of the electricity companies price gouging? I know they're paying more for electricity and it's not, most of them aren't taking it out of the ground or whatever, right? They're buying it on the markets. But SSE electricity putting up prices by 35-40%, there's an element of profit in there as well.
Well, yeah, but they wouldn't be the only company. And there was a very interesting article by John Fitzgerald in the Irish Times last Friday that talked about the complexity of the market. But anyway, he also said that He said in Europe. Now, he didn't say where, and I didn't research it, that an awful lot of companies have actually gone bust because of this particular crisis. You know,
France essentially had to nationalise their electricity company. But I heard that bills in France, electricity bills, are only gone up by 8% in the last year. So they have decided
because they've nationalised it, they can do it. Yeah. And that's the difference.
Yeah.
But one thing is, we have to look at a situation where people do reduce their electricity consumption so low that they end up getting slapped with an extra charge for low usage. That's something that needs to be phased out, because if we want people to use less electricity, you can't get punished for it at the end of the day.
OK, Robert Troy. So, Alison, election candidates disclosing their business interests before they run.
Yeah, I think that there's that on the front page, and there's also a very good column by Elaine Byrne inside on this. So on the outside, it's saying that, surprise, surprise, Michael McGrath, who's the Minister for Public Expenditure, is there talking about a review of the current ethics laws are underway, major overhaul, and this idea that that if you're a candidate, you would declare these things. And I think that that's no harm at all. I think
but the ethics legislation should always be business. You know, it should be work in progress. You know, and I think
it's been a work that's been.
Yeah, it is. But it only comes to a highlight because something happens that triggers it in everyone
else's
mind.
Elaine is making the point, Elaine Byrne, that she gave evidence in 2015 to an Oireachtas committee on SIPO and on our ethics legislation, and that she's basically saying that it's 7 years and three governments since 2015, and basically that this legislation proposed then was died a death of willful disregard, and that SIPO occupies the role of bystander, basically. And I mean, this is...
makes the point about that one of the reasons apparently it fell was that the Councillors Representative Association came up and argued that if things were too strict, that people wouldn't run for councils. And you imagine, Jennifer Kavanagh, if people were... had to lay all their cards on the table just to run for any job in politics, would it put a lot of people off?
I honestly don't think so. And considering one of my research areas is actually electoral law, it's something I've actually looked at, in a research field. But I do think that people need to have transparency on who is actually looking for their vote. That there has been reports from SIPO, I think their last one even picked out all the bits they had recommended, and that nothing had been done on them. The focus in the legislative space on this has been on the Electoral Commission and the Electoral Reform Bill. And I do think that the changes that were necessary to the Ethics and Public Office legislation was put on the back burner. And there is the review coming into it, and it really does need to be strengthened. And if SIPO are telling the government there are problems in this particular space, they are the experts. They are dealing with this legislation day in, day out. We really should speed up bringing in that proper ethics legislation, which SIPO has been talking about. And honestly, if somebody is running for election, it shouldn't be a case that we find out what they own after they get in, when that is actually something that a lot of people would be wondering about. And we all know local elections, there could be rumour mills coming in and the like. We need to have transparency on what the interests are. And it's even getting to a situation, because it was pointed out in one or two of the papers, say Robert Troy and lobbying returns from his wife, that maybe we should also be looking at spouses and what sort of interests they have.
No, there's no suggestion that his wife did anything unethical. It's all there. It's on the lobbying register, and she is a professional in her own right who is entitled to do her job and everything. Owen, the politics of this, you picked out a piece in the Mail on Sunday, Fury After the Fall of Troy. This is John Lee and Craig Hughes, suggesting that this has created a rift now between Fianna Fáil and the Greens. What is your read on the whole...
It's different for government. I suppose you're damned if you do, if you're damned if you don't. People are saying that the Taoiseach didn't move quick enough or supported too readily and too willingly too early. But if you look at it from his point of view, even ministers are entitled to kind of be able to explain themselves. And Robert Troy early on was saying, look, I can account for this, it was a genuine mistake. And, you know, and the Taoiseach was obviously allowing him time in order to clarify that. And it was getting, it was going on.
So what happened?
Well, I think it was going on too long. There was, you know, debt by a thousand cuts, drip feed every day. There was something new every day. The portfolio was probably getting bigger and bigger all the time. And I think at the very end that possibly that interview by Eamon Ryan, you know, triggered things. And that is the inference in that John Lee is saying in the paper today that, that you know, that the support... That he didn't, maybe Robert Troy didn't feel that he had the full support of Eamon Ryan at the thing. And and he was calling for him to go. And apparently Robert Troy at that point was willing to do what Eamon Ryan was proposing that he would do.
This is what I don't get, Alison. I'm probably wrong here. My read on what Eamon Ryan was saying was I thought Eamon Ryan is doing Robert Troy a favour here by trying to kick this into touch, put it into committee as we do with things, or put it into an inquiry, and that maybe this gets him through the crucial days he needs to get through without going, and it's dealt with.
But I suppose there was a very
long finger.
But there was also a great distance between what Eamon Ryan was saying and what the Taoiseach, the Tánaiste, had said in their very vocal backing of him, and most particularly if you like the Tánaiste, Leo Varadkar, the leader of Fine Gael, who really gave his absolute and full backing to him. And I think, as Eoin was saying, I think at that stage it was just becoming clear that this thing had got way too messy. And that I think that Robert Troy's statement, where he was clear that he's very sore in a number of points, he's not really entitled to be. He could have come out much clearer at the start of this, that this drip of information. There was a funny cartoon in the Examiner yesterday where you had Robert Troy coming back into his office saying, "Oh, I forgot my keys." And lying on the table was this big bunch of keys, nearly something like a prison officer would have felt years ago. And that he, you know, that in the current situation where we have a housing crisis, where even if you were, as he said, he left school, like if you were 20, and you started, you know, saving now and all of that, you might never own a house.
Okay, so I mean, hang on a minute. It was the problem here not that... So his problem was tone deafness. Yeah. It was not actually technically that he had done anything wrong.
Oh, no, it was. And this is the thing, going back to that column by Elaine Byrne. There is nowhere... I mean, so I sometimes say at home, if there's something with the kids in the house, I say, there is nowhere near enough fear in this house. Well, there's nowhere near enough fear in Leinster House about the repercussions, or there wasn't, of what would happen if you didn't pay proper attention to your ethics declarations. And that is quite clear, even from the number of TDs who've come in subsequently and have to make changes. SIPO have been crying out for change and to be given more powers. And all of the politicians are very reluctant to do that. And then they complain when they say the government, the public are cynical and think that you know, the politicians are all in it for themselves. This is a perfect example of why.
But yeah, but equally, I suppose the point has been made that Robert Troy really didn't have anything to gain out of this, like that what it was. It was a breach of an obligation under ethics legislation. It's now under investigation by SIPO. Yeah. Like all the changes in the world won't change what happened.
Not declaring it when you're speaking in debates. That's another thing. Just wrong.
Does everyone have to declare every conflict of interest or any interest in anything?
Honestly and reasonably.
And so Jennifer, the people have made the parallel with farmers in the Dáil. People have made the parallel with... So I saw somebody say, should Pascal Donoghue, because he has children, declare an interest anytime children's allowance comes up? I suppose people are kind of asking, how far do you go with that?
But you look at some of the judges. There was one high profile judge was looking at a legal issue to do with a mortgage from a particular provider and actually declared in the judgment, by the way, my mortgage is actually with them. I'm just putting it there so everyone is aware.
That's one judge that we know of. How many judges are declaring conflicts of interest in our potential interest the judgments they're doing?
Anyone, and it's settled law under the law of bias, under admin law, if it's looked on that you could possibly have some sort of more knowledge about this or something to gain from it, it should always be declared. Even judges who have sat on original cases and appeals. But at the end of the day, with Robert Troy, with any political scandal that keeps going, once it goes past a week, you have to go. Sure, we saw it.
Can
with
I just
Phil Hogan.
Take you back though to how would this system work? Would people recuse themselves every time anything came up that impacted on them directly?
Well, if it is something that they could be seen to have more of a connection to, they should. And that is what is there in law. Now, if you're going to the level of children's allowance, I mean, that is actually bringing it to the minutiae of the situation.
Or it's bringing it down to a direct financial gain that everybody is getting every month. If you're arguing to put it up and you're going to gain from it.
If you are someone in a position where you've that many rental houses and you are bringing in issues in a debate, it shouldn't be any problem just to say, by the way, I do have a number of houses myself, but I'm talking from the position of my constituents, because that means then there isn't the whole cynicism of people not trusting politicians can be dealt with, because it'll be a case of it'll be there on the Dáil record and what they have anyway will be there on the Register of Members' Interests.
Yeah, OK.
Martin, and it's only Boris Johnson really that we don't know how many. Sorry, Martin. It's only Boris Johnson that nobody really knows how many children
he has. And the children's allowance, Martin.
Well, look, I read somewhere recently, was it 35% of the people in the Dáil are also landlords? I also read that Robert Troy himself used his Dáil time to speak about raising the money available for the HAP scheme, which he was a recipient of. I mean, it's not just about not declaring certain things. It's also about arguing for things that's definitely going to benefit you financially.
Yeah, and I don't think he didn't break any rule there, though.
No, but this is about, like, it's not a rule. If maybe we should look at what rules should be, maybe, in a situation like that. But what does it say about a country where 35% of the representatives in the Dáil are all landowners, and we have the massive housing crisis that we have at the moment? And then you have politicians, but hang on, then you have politicians who are using their Dáil time to talk about something that will benefit them as a landlord. And also, just to remember as well, the same Robert Troy bought a house in County Longford. Within 3 months, he sold it back to Longford County Council.
To be very clear in that, he bought a house that I think he says was more or less derelict, was uninhabitable. He spent money on doing it up.
So within 3 months of buying it,
he bought it, I think, in a public auction that anyone could have bought it and done the same thing.
Does it not raise questions, though, Brendan? I know, and this is not a conspiracy theory part of me, but rationally, think about this, about the time frame of that. You buy a house that's derelict, you do it up, and within 3 months of buying it, fixing it up, it's already in the hands of Longford County Council for double the price that you paid for it.
He did spend money on doing it up. Sorry, Jennifer, I'll bring you in a second. He did spend money on doing it up, and then it was put up for sale, I gather. I think I'm correct in saying, Alison, publicly as well.
Within three months of buying it.
All operated on the open market. There's no conspiracy theory there.
Absolutely, but always with the sense of inside track, knowing the right people, knowing the contract.
Let's be very fair and very clear here. There was no inside track here. He is adamant about that.
But Brendan, what I'm saying is, my use of that phrase is to do with, if you are someone who hasn't a hope of getting onto the property ladder, it feels like it raises the question whether the question is based on reality or not.
Is that why Robert Troy is gone? Because it felt wrong to people like you, Martin, and people were annoyed because it didn't feel
good. He fell on the sword because at the end of the day, 35% of the people that are sitting in beside him are in a similar situation. And if the quickest way to get rid of this, fall on your sword, resign, and let's get rid of the issue.
It was more than feeling. That was just a part of it.
Okay. We're going to be joined now by Gabby Fulham, who's the new student union president of Trinity College Dublin. Good morning, Gabby.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So listen, Gabby, third level students heading back to college soon. And as we all know, a huge accommodation crisis here. Can you paint a picture for us of how bad this is?
Great. Yeah, definitely. So we run an advisory service where if you have a dig, you can advertise it. And if you're a student, you come to us for advice on finding accommodation. What we're seeing here with recent years in terms of government increase of spaces in third level without having the relevant facilities, we're kind of reaching this sort of emergency in terms of students that will come to Dublin or may not be able to come to Dublin with nowhere to live. And basically, you look at the possibility of them needing to drop out or not taking up their place. We need to kind of know what happens to them. And we also have seen with
this. So some people are literally not going to be able to go to college, not take up college places.
Yeah, 100%. And what we've seen is with this kind of increase in supply or increase in demand for student accommodation in some capacity, we know that that means more students are likely to be in unsafe or unsuitable circumstances because they take anywhere they can. We know we get things in our advisory service like landlords trying to advertise a 5-day digs for over €1,000 a month without utilities or kind of crazy expensive unsuitable things like that, who are trying to take advantage of the situation. So we see more students, firstly, living in unsafe, unsuitable or unstable situations, often paying excessive or huge amounts of rent. And then we also know that there are huge amounts of students that are due to start college in a couple of weeks with nowhere to live and don't know kind of what will happen to them or what that situation might be.
And I know you're involved in the USI protest on October 14th. What are you calling on the government to do?
So basically what we need is affordability to be central to future state-led investments in housing. We obviously want to see things like a rent phase, retention of all public and state-owned land. We also want them to stop increasing spaces in third level without having the facilities to make sure that these students can actually be assisted and taking up those spaces. And beyond that, we also need kind of the relevant, we actually need in the immediate future is sort of some sort of plan or guidance or support for students that might have somewhere to live, that might either firstly become unstable or unsuitable or not find anywhere to live in the first instance.
Okay. And look, much like the energy thing, it sounds like a lot of that is stuff that's not going to happen in the immediate term. So I suppose it still leaves us with an immediate crisis. Okay, Gabby Fulham, Student Union President of Trinity College Dublin, thank you very much. Jennifer Kavanagh, you take an interest in this area. You've picked out a piece in the Mail on Sunday about that student protest.
Yeah, they say that there's 1,056 extra places for students this year in first year, and that's on top of an increase that happened last year.
Well,
as well.
Sorry, 1,056 extra places in courses.
In courses. And all the students' union people who are talking on this are absolutely right that there's an increase in places, but there's no look at what sort of accommodation is available. And the thing is that a lot of students are pushed either by parents or guidance counsellors and the like to the bigger universities. And a lot of this could be remedied by people choosing the course that is local to them, because Sligo has a great Institute of Technology, now part of the Atlantic Technological University. Waterford, we're now at Southeast Technological University. There's plenty of good third level courses that are around the country where students don't have to go to the likes of Cork, Dublin, Galway.
And you know, Jennifer, that people will probably bridle at the thought that they're being told, you know, well, look, just do a different course, but do it nearer home because there's nowhere for you to stay if you do the course you want to do.
But all courses, take business studies, they are all benchmarked against the QQI level framework. So a level 8 degree in business or engineering has to have comparable learning outcomes to any other business or engineering course or any other course that you want to look at. And there's plenty, like a lot of students now do feel like they need to go on and do master's courses. And they're 1 year, so say for accountancy, you get extra exemptions if you do a master's, which turns college into a 5-year process for many. And 5 years of living away from home is a lot of money to begin with for parents. And if there's accommodation problems to this extent, a lot of stress. I mean, I've had students who were commuting 4 hours every day for college courses.
Seriously? Or
yes, I had that last year. A lot of students spending up to 6 weeks in hotels on nightly rates. That there's so many problems that I'm surprised the students haven't had a strike before this date.
Okay, Owen, this is of course is just an aspect of a broader picture, isn't it?
It is indeed, and I heard the Minister for Higher Education, Simon Harris, he was actually addressing it there recently, and he said all options were on the table in order to address this, including modular, and they've been talking about modular for refugees as well. But I don't know whether it's a central government thing. We don't see any modulars yet to any great scale, at least. So I don't know how they're going to resolve the problem, square this particular circle. You know, is there opportunities of using kind of remote learning or whatever? Because the problem is in the here and now, and any solution that is put forward will take time. There's a lead time in it, and the students are in college within weeks now.
Yeah, in fairness, I suppose you'd have to say that the government is also dealing with a surprise of 50,000 Ukrainians, not all requiring accommodation from the state, but they are mixed up in that system there as well. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be doing that, but that is part of the issue, isn't it, Martin?
I mean, it is, and it's one of those situations because, of course, you've got people fleeing a war-torn country, but that doesn't change the feeling of the people who might be on a social housing list for the last 15 to 20 years. That doesn't change the situation for single mothers in Galway who are living in modular homes with dampness and with grey water outside their front door, or and in temporary accommodation that's lasted for 2 or 3 years. It doesn't change the feeling for them. And in actual fact, I can see that building resentment. And it's all based around the lack of, I suppose, accessible housing for anyone, really. But just going back to the education thing, I actually did my master's all online with UL.
And this was before remote learning and teaching was a thing, is it?
No, just last year.
Okay.
Yeah, it was all online. Absolutely no difference whatsoever. So the remote learning...
People would say, did you miss out on the experience, the social side of things, the, you know, kind of mixing it up with
you
your
balance,
fellow...
You balance that off. I mean, you don't go to college just for the social experience. It isn't an educational pursuit. We've told ourselves that it's all part of socialising. Look, we're
Martin,
not yet. But
if you go off to college and you're 18 or 19, I mean, the social... I mean, they think of the... I think maybe it's different when you're a bit older and doing a master's. But if you're kids who've been stuck in their rooms, particularly for the last 2 years, now this idea that they have the chance to get out of their bedrooms and on campus, and that there isn't the accommodation for them. I mean, it's a key part of
What's the point of having a great university experience? Let's have a great night out and we'll drink for 7 days in a week and we'll sleep on a bench in the park. What is the point in having a great night out if you can't have a lie-in?
No, but the thing is for students that when you go away or when you go into college, that it's not just what you're learning about your subject area, it's also what you're learning about yourself. And to be honest with you, remote teaching is not going to be the answer here, because if you have actually managed to get accommodation, you've signed on to a degree programme, and now you're being told actually 2 days you don't actually need to be here, the students who've managed to get accommodation are then going to feel like, well, I'm wasting money then for 2-3 nights, where if I knew this before I went in, I could have actually made different arrangements that wouldn't have cost me as much money.
I suppose the point of what I was trying to make was, for me, it worked for me. And you know what? It might work, even if it worked for 10% or 20% of the students that are going into these new courses. That's 10 to 20% less people seeking accommodation. That might alleviate it somewhat. And you know what? If it was actually incentivized by the universities and said, here's a 20% discount if you do it online, you're going to find an awful lot of families going for that option.
Yeah.
And you can't bring in a discount for remote teaching, because the library facilities, the IT, the teaching staff costs will actually be pretty much the same. And that was a huge argument over COVID.
Well, in my experience of the last year, the in situ classes still happened, but there was a webcam set up, so those at home were still getting the exact same lecture, but you were doing it from your PC.
So and double your IT budget, so you'll have someone on standby if the webcams collapse.
Could you not also, Jennifer, you know, remember this thing, massive online courses and learning that was going to revolutionise the whole university thing? And a lot of people do think that universities are kind of, can be a little bit resistant to the modern world. Could you not open it up for all kinds of people, people with disabilities, maybe people, you know, if you just... Put it out there. Let the people join.
I completely agree with you. But what people forget is the regulation behind higher education, that if you want to change a course, even to have one module online, that has to be tested by external panels to make sure they're getting the same quality education.
And
did
that not all happen in the last couple of years?
Well, we had emergency remote teaching for COVID, so it was a band-aid stuck in it. I completely agree there should be far more online learning, but the thing is, you can't take a course that is meant for bricks and mortars in the lecture hall teaching on the long term to adapt it for online.
Well,
I know that you're taking a high-minded view of it, like, but there are a lot of people I knew.
It's not high-minded, your regulation.
This is 30 years ago or more, who might as well have been online because they never went near a lecture and they got the notes off someone else, and most of them did fine in the end. Martin, would you have been able to go to college to do that master's if there hadn't been the online option?
No, I would have had the time. And you know what, just even going beyond that, there's a whole... it was last year actually they were talking about opening up these hubs across the country where people could go in, you know, work within the area, you get to rent out your space or you have your space. If you opened up remote learning across the country, you then get access to communities who wouldn't have historically been able to go to university, people who couldn't afford to get that accommodation in the cities. And then you could also reach out and go to community groups where people, maybe the elderly in the community, want to upskill or get a diploma. You're reaching more people by just, I suppose, allowing the option to learn remotely. I'm not saying it's the overall solution.
Given that this is the first positive, actual kind of solution to any of these omni-shambles that we've been presented with in the whole hour, I kind of think we should take it seriously. Is Martin not talking a lot of sense here?
Oh, he absolutely is. And I mean, for example, if people are doing the preparatory courses for the FE1s, they are done remotely across the country and there's notes and everything. So there is scope there, but it's okay. Just making sure that things are done with the requisite quality so you don't end up with students on a course for 2 years. Then the regulatory authority looks at it and your validation gets pulled.
OK, well, listen, I'm glad we ended up after that dire hour of misery that we ended up on a positive note there. Martin Beansward talking possibly a solution. Owner Knocked On, Martin Beansward, Alison O'Connor and Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh. Thanks a million. I have to take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.